Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Unemployment claims skyrocket. More market records during the week and a $2 trillion stimulus bill. Our guest today is Dan Fajella, founder of Emerge Artificial Intelligence Research. All this and much more on episode number 655 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. So welcome to the new world. I'm Andrew Horowitz, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as the co-host for DH Unplugged, where I get together each and every week with John C. Dvorak, and we talk about news, items, issues relevant to the investment world, the economy, all sorts of things that we are faced with right now. You can check that out on DH Unplugged. As a matter of fact, each and every Tuesday night at 9 p.m., we have the opportunity to have not only us talking to each other, but we also have a chat room. So if you want to attend that, it's a live stream at dhunplugged.com, 9 o'clock on Tuesday evenings. So this week, I've been doing a lot of research. I mean, I've been doing an incredible amount of research, a grueling week, let's be honest. Very early in the morning, I got to the office. Very late in the evenings, I left. And basically, what I was trying to do is get a handle on just what the future holds and really understanding what's happening with the markets, where we're going with this, the economic outlook, et cetera. And I want to thank everybody, first of all, for all the emails and the tweets and the kind letters, the support. This is a joint effort. This is something that we do together. It is something that we do as a team. It's not just myself talking to you. It's you also reacting and giving me your input. So I want to thank you for that. It means a lot to me, especially in these very, very difficult times. So over the week, I've talked to, I would say, hundreds of people from all sorts of places, all sorts of areas of the business world. I wanted to really find out what it was that they were doing, what was they were seeing on a personal level as well as on a business level. So some people I talked to were just people that were maybe out of work for a while, some people that I know that are quarantined, some people that I know that are in the business world. And you know, it's interesting because whether it was the people in India, Pakistan, I talked to people in the Virgin Islands, all over the United States, Canada, pretty much everybody has the same thought process and what's going on, right? They're very concerned. They're very nervous. They feel like their life has changed dramatically because either they're not allowed to socialize or at least social distance, and they have a regiment, which is pretty much get up, maybe stay at home and do some work, which is very difficult for them with the kids hanging around. Or maybe what they have is the opportunity to go to work for at least a little while, if it's maybe an office that is requiring them to do so or they want to go to. And each and every one of them, aside from their personal struggle and their own social issues right now, said pretty much the same thing. They were worried. They were uncertain. They were scared. But they were being careful. Now, I could tell you stories of what I've seen down here in Florida on the beach, on the boat, around town, people not being careful. But I think finally, it's starting to get into their heads that, you know what, we need to be worried about this in a way that we do something about it. In fact, in Broward County, in Fort Lauderdale, there's a stay-at-home order unless to go to certain essential jobs, media, podcasting, you know, a variety of other things. I come here. I'm alone in my office, kind of closed door, doing my thing. There's one other person here with me. Otherwise, there's nobody here, and we're very far apart. We don't get near each other. Constantly Cloroxing everything and staying very careful. But of course, I mean, you need to be that level and provide that level of care because, you know what? It's not only for us. It's for the other people. The other people with immune systems that may not be able to handle it, like asthma or elderly. So everybody's in the same boat right now, right? These are the professionals I talk to and CEOs and traders, retirees, just ordinary people like you and me. Right now, we're all the same. However you want to look at it, we're all the same. So I think we need to realize that right now, when we look at what is happening and how we are in fact dealing with this, this is our fate. And we need to figure out what to do right now for the time being until this issue is over, and then prepare for who knows what in the coming years that this may happen. We need to deal with this in a way that we can in fact have a reasonable life when we're in fact in a shutdown or a quarantine or a lockdown situation without going totally insane. I mean, the truth of the matter is that this is very difficult for a lot of people. Now, I know that you know this, but when you get to the point here that there is a lot of concern about not only our personal health, but also about our financial health right now. I mean, yes, we saw that $3.2 trillion bill that was passed, and you're going to get $1,200 for each person if you make under a certain amount of income. Unemployment compensation was raised and extended, a $600 per week for some people. Bailouts for other industries, and the list goes on and on and on where this money is going to flow to. And that could, in fact, at least hopefully create some level of floor somewhere. I'm not saying it's right here for the markets and for your portfolios. But it's not just about the markets and our jobs. You know, we're all very tense. We can't go out. We can't make the same have the same ability to make the decisions that we usually make because we're really concerned and scared about things. And we're worried about supplies, toilet paper. We're worried about food. We're worried about when can we get back to work. I talked to some people in the retail industry that are closing their doors for an extended period of time starting Monday. Had to lay off half of their employees. Never before in their 30 years have they actually laid off people. So when we're looking at this, this is not, again, about just them or how it affects those people that are maybe in cluster areas that have a big problem. It's all of us because the supply chain, the markets, the economy, our finances, it's all of us. So when we look at this, I mean, I think that when this whole bad news is hitting every single second, and we have the constant count of people that are ill, infected from our counties and our cities and our country and the world, it's very difficult to make a decision during that period of time. And listen, the only thing missing right now is flesh-eating zombies. That would kind of make this whole thing seem a lot more like, oh, yeah, okay, that's much more normal than what we have here, because this is kind of an invisible zombie that is causing all these problems. Very difficult to understand when it's attacking us and whether or not we can go outside, talk to people and all that. It's a real issue right now. And I think that it's not a time to make any rash decisions, because the problem is when you make these rash decisions in a time when you're so stressed, you're probably not thinking them through. So we're all trying to make sense of all this right now. And, you know, one of the things we've been doing, and I'll mention to you, is that each and every Monday and Wednesday, starting at 4:30, I thought it'd be a really good idea to do a Q&A, a pop-up webinar, where you can ask any questions you want. I'll do my best to answer those questions. I'm not going to have all the answers, I'll tell you right now. But, you know, if in fact I can help you with some of your financial questions, the outlook, the issues that are going on, well, that's what I'm going to do. So what you can do is go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I just put up a new little link on the top right of the homepage where you can just register for those webinars. And we're going to do this until we get back to some normalcy. I don't know when that is. I have no idea when that's going to be. But we're going to do it for a while to make sure that we are all understanding what is going on and you have the opportunity to ask the questions that you need to ask in terms of what is going on. I mean, how do we even reconcile the fact that we got this $3.2 trillion and 3.2 or 3.1, whatever the exact number was, of people unemployed in 1 week? And the thought that it's going to get worse, that upwards of, I don't know, 15, 20 million people could be unemployed. Now, mind you, that may be temporary. It may be transitory until this whole thing resolves. But the knock-on effects from this kind of economic devastation have got to be significant. We're going to see airlines having to beg for money. Cruise lines, they're all anchored right now off of Fort Lauderdale. Not all of them, but the ones that come down here are anchored one after another outside of the Fort Lauderdale Inlet, off of the Miami Inlet. Anywhere there's a major hub for cruise lines, they're just offshore. The travel and leisure industry, the hospitality industry, is going to be hit extremely hard. And that being the case, that reverberates through the entire economy. The unemployment rate is not going to come down for some time, because even if we get through this on a reasonable period, I don't know, what's the date? Is it going to be April 30th? It's not going to be April 12th. The whole idea of April 12th is out the window. We haven't even reached peak anywhere in the world at this point, except for possibly China. When it is going to peak over here? I don't know. Do we believe the numbers from China? I don't know. Can I say that maybe we're going to be at least into the next 30 days trying to find a level that is going to be leveling off in terms of the amount of people that are getting this horrible condition? I think it's going to be taking some time. So we have to really focus in on what we're going to do here and the, again, these knock-on effects that are happening long-term. And I mentioned before, I'm going to mention it again, we're all in this together. And, you know, we need to support each other. We need to understand what's going on. But at the same time, we don't need to have the extra added pain that goes along with financial devastation. This financial situation, the incredible amount of volatility with markets, the unbelievable amount of financial destruction that is going to go on from now over the next few months and probably next couple of years as we get adjusted to this situation is real. There's no question about that in my mind. It's real. And one of the things that's really fascinating is, if you remember, I said back a few weeks ago, I started this whole idea that during my birthday month, I turned 55. And I said, you know, as a reverse birthday gift, I was going to start to look at the idea of, hey, let's review some portfolios, something we've never done before. I said, you know, let's review portfolios for people and figure out if we could send them a nice report back and make sure they're at least allocated in a reasonable way according to their particular risk profile. And you know what happened? Is that I got back an overwhelming amount of portfolios to look at. We're really backed up with these. We'll get to them. And by the way, you have a couple more days to put those in over on thedisciplinedinvestoragain.com. You can tap on the Ask Andrew navigation bar on the top and it drops down as a secure portfolio upload page that will pop up. But basically, what I have found from all of these that I've looked at so far is that there is a significant amount of risk that has been taken compared to the actual results. And what I mean by that is this risk-reward trade-off is really important when you consider what you're investing in. I think what's happened is that people got complacent, more than complacent. They got ingrained in the idea that, yeah, I don't care about risk. The Fed's got my back. And not only does the Fed have my back, but look at the government. Man, they're pro-markets. And not only that, we had the passive ETFs and the passive investment strategies pumping us full of information over the years that said the only way you want to invest is into these passive types of investments. And now that the Fed has said basically that the economic cycle is dead, well, why not invest forever keeping the same exact allocation, which is go, 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 mo, momentum, into just equities? Because you know what? They always come back. And there's not a lot to really worry about. So when I looked at this and I saw all this risk that was going on inside of portfolios, I started wondering what is going on here. Returns, even before this situation that we see right here, really were, I would say, well above the risk range considering reward. We look at like things like alpha, beta, Sharpe ratios, Sortino ratios. We look at all these things that can quantify how much risk is actually being taken for the result, for the reward on this. And the problem has been that not only were people allocated incorrectly, or I would say not diversified well, that's probably a better way to put it, diversified well, but what happened is that they got crushed in this recent downturn. And I think I'm going to do a little preaching here for a second. Let me do a little bit of preaching, kind of get my preacher outfit on and tell you something. Because if you've been listening to us for a long time, listening to this particular podcast, we've been doing this for how many years now? Since 2007? You know we try to educate and we try to teach. And at the same time, we even sometimes force the idea of diversification on you. We try to really pump the idea very dramatically about the whole reason and rationale why you want to be diversified. And that takes on a lot of different meanings to different people. But diversified within your portfolio, making sure that you don't have a lot of overlap and overlay inside of your funds and your stocks. And in addition to that, to make sure that you have things that are uncorrelated to maybe the equity markets that could provide you for some downside risk when things are getting a little crazy. But what I saw was people swinging for the fences. So I'm not sure if there was a dislocation from what we've been talking about, or people just got like really interested in the whole idea of, man, these markets are going and they're never coming down. This whole idea of the economic cycle being halted and there's no longer going to be downturns, I think we know right now that the fact is that's not true. So, you know, I'm not listening to all the, I'm on Twitter right now. By the way, for the recording, we're doing a Twitter live feed as we record this today. And I'm not reading all the things, but I like that. I'm diversified. I have bourbon and vodka, somebody just said. That's great. That's a good one. So that makes a lot of sense. But with regard to this, I think that the idea of diversification, when we get times like this, really starts to like, oh man, I should have done that. And the question is it too late? I don't think so. I think that even if you live in the desert, you should probably carry an umbrella with you sometimes. Just to be safe. And just in case, you don't know what's happening. There could be a torrential downpour out of nowhere that just happens. You don't know. You're not in control of that. You're not in control of the markets. And as such, that level of diversification by holding things like, I don't know, you could have precious metals and maybe some commodities in there. They haven't done well for a while, but precious metals are picking up dramatically. Gold's doing really well. You could have things like short-term, mid-term, long-term bonds, domestic, international. Add to that some alternative assets. There's a whole host of things that you could have done. And as I looked at many of these portfolios, what had happened was when I paired them up with a benchmark that was like about a 60-40, 60% equities, 40% bonds, what I found was really interesting that most of these portfolios, even if they were really aggressive and primarily in equities, performed just as well, but had a lot more risk in them as compared to the 60-40 benchmark. So for the most part, these portfolios were, in other words, while invested in ETFs and stocks and mutual funds, they were more aggressive with less return than a more conservative portfolio benchmark. That's a problem. And the question you have to ask yourself is, why am I doing this? What is the purpose of what I'm doing with this investing? Is it for fun? You know, some people, you want to day trade. That's great. No problem with that. You want to swing trade? I have no problem with that either. I'm all for it, in fact. But if, in fact, if you could actually look at what is going on with your portfolio and the actual goals and the purpose and your risk tolerance and your time horizon, put that all into a combination, kind of a recipe, mix it all up. What do we come out with? We're probably doing this for the long term, for our future, maybe our retirement, maybe for our kids and the future generations. This is not a time to be cavalier about your investments and to just simply look at, well, I don't know, the markets always come back. Do they? Yeah, recently they have. we're in a much different situation right now, and I would dare tell you that it requires a little bit more finesse and discipline to actually get those kind of returns over time that you're looking for, because I think the volatility is going to knock a lot of people out. And, you know, if the question is, hey, Andrew, is the market going to come back? Eventually. But the question still remains, are there other alternatives that you could invest in a diversified manner that will have less potential volatility? Nothing's guaranteed, but that will give you the opportunity to make money over the long haul without any of these problems. You know, here's a question. And I'm gonna hit the Twitters with this. The question is, if you have $100,000 and you lose 50%, now you're down to $50,000, right? If you lose 50%, you have $100,000, you lose 50%, you're down to $50,000. How much in percent do you have to make in order to get back to $100,000? So we're down to 50,000. We just lost 50,000. How much in percent do we have to get back to make it back to $100,000? Well, a lot of people are going to say, well, it's 50%. I lost 50%. I got to make 50%, right? Nope. If you lost 50% on your money, you got to make 100% back. If you're at 50,000, you got to make 100% back to actually get to where you were before. And you know what? When's the last time you made 100% on your money in a reasonable period of time? It's pretty tough. It's pretty tough. Now, off the bottom, what we saw last week was this 20% rise. Well, I guess we netted out to about a 17% rise off of the bottom last week, which I would classify as a dead cat bounce or a bear market bounce. It was kind of like, oh, I got to get in, and people started freaking out. We had a major, and we're going to have a little bit more, but a major rotation and rebalancing that's going on with institutions into the month end and also into the quarter end. So you pay attention to that. But, however, if you looked at any other important and significant downtrends with this kind of action in the market, this is far from over. Now, you know what? It's okay. You don't have to be in all cash right now. There are opportunities that are going to arise. But to be diversified and to have the right portfolio structure to make sure that you defend, you know, you're both on defense and offense at the same time is really important. And, you know, we've had a massive amount of stimulus that came into the markets over the last few weeks. The Fed is pumping trillions of dollars into the bond market. And the economic outlook is pretty bad. Matter of fact, it's the worst I've ever seen. And while this all may be temporary, as I talked about, as a lot of us are thinking that, okay, this kind of level of where we're going to be with the level of unemployment and claims and GDP just going in the toilet on a global basis may in fact be temporary. Again, this is going to be a problem. So back in 2008, I talked about something. And back in 2008, when people were getting a little bit, you know, concerned and upset and worried about the money, didn't know what to do, I tried to get into their head something. And I tried to ask the question, what is your strategy? A lot of people said, you know, I hope the market comes back. And I tried to go one step further and say, listen, shake them a little bit. Say, listen, hope is not a strategy. Seriously. It is not a strategy that you can implement inside a portfolio. You have to be ahead of the curve and make sure that you have all areas covered. You got to make sure you have that umbrella, even if you're in the desert. You got to make sure you have those bonds, even though the market may be in rally mode. Spend just a moment, just a little while thinking about what you've done, questioning whether you've been proactive or not, and whether or not, you know, there's something that you need to think about. And whether you're just letting the markets take you by the nose and riding you around, or if in fact you are in charge of your destiny. Seriously. Told you I was going to get preachy here. This is the time to get serious. This is the time to really focus in on yourself and making sure you are protected, not only from the health side of things, but financially. And I mean this very, very seriously. You need to make sure that you are protecting yourself in every aspect of your life. And that includes the financial side. And whether you need a money manager to help you and you've been resistant to it because, oh, I could do this. It's so easy. Look at that. I'll just invest in that ETF and, oh, everything's going to be fine. Well, you know now, it's not going to be. I provided you research over the years about why not utilizing ETFs for bonds, not having a passive strategy for bonds, for emerging markets, for developing international markets. I've explained to you why it's okay to pay a little bit higher in mutual funds for those particular areas and utilizing ETFs primarily for your domestic and your more efficient markets. And I think that's really holds well right now. Don't let hope be your strategy. I think that's a real big mistake. I think that's really, in what we are about to see here, come on, you think about it. Yes, I hope that this all ends very quickly, but the fact of the matter is, it's not going to. The economic situation is not going to get very well, and I'm going to just say for a minute, I'm going to tell you Twitter too. I don't usually say this, every once in a while mention it, but I'm going to tell you, if you need help, I am here. That's what we do. We are investment advisors, money managers, financial planners, whatever you want to call it. Reach out to me. Reach out to me. I'm here. I'll talk to you. We'll figure out what's going on, figure out what the best thing is for you at this time, which, by the way, may mean doing nothing. But it's time to really focus in on that and to really get serious about that. All right, with that, we're going to get to our guest today, and it should be interesting. We're going to get to the topic of AI, artificial intelligence, particularly in the area of working on how it impacts or how it could be utilized in the investment world. So let's get to that right now. And our guest today is Daniel Fajella, and he is the founder and head of research of Emerge Artificial Intelligence Research, and they do a lot of work in the area of decision-making, market research, and helping on areas that can really help companies. We're going to get to that, and I'm going to ask him about that, but I think it's going to be pretty cool because we've all talked about the whole AI for a long time, tape reading algos, and the whole idea of where it is that, you know, we're seeing all this action, and what do actually these algos do, and how does AI work in terms of not only investment, but decision-making in general? So, Daniel, how are you?
Doing well. Glad to be with you, Andrew.
You all boxed up inside of this whole containment?
Oh, man. Tell me about it, yeah, right? Yeah, that's a wild run recently, but not too bad.
Good, good. As long as you're healthy and everything's going well. So let's talk a little bit about Emerge, and let's talk about AI. So let's first of all, I think, just back up and let's give a definition of what is AI?
Yeah, roughly speaking, I mean, probably the best broad, we actually have an article defining this as well as machine learning. There's a lot of different opinions. So the best broad perspective is essentially when a machine or computer is doing something that otherwise a human would need to do. Now, you would say that that's a very broad definition, and I would say you're right, but that's probably about as good as it gets. Normally today, when people say AI, what they mean is machine learning, which is sort of a more modern approach to artificial intelligence that's taken off in the last decade. But more or less, we're talking about machines doing things that we wouldn't be able to hard code. These are machines doing things that like a human being could. So roughly speaking, that's probably about as good as we can get without boxing ourselves in too narrowly.
So when you say machine learning, it all has to start with coding of something and some idea of what it's to be looking for. Are you saying that there's an evolution of the thinking process of the machine, or is there a limitation based on what was programmed to begin with?
Yeah, so there are certainly systems that technically by many, even hardcore academics in the space, would be called artificial intelligence, but are more or less sort of hard-coded. You know, there's a whole phase of quote-unquote expert systems where we ask human beings how they make decisions and we build these gigantic trees with different kind of ratios and proportions and sort of decision making that will happen at different nodes. But more or less, it's kind of hard baked in there. You know, even a simple example like credit card fraud, you know, it wasn't a machine that would quote unquote learn. It was just a machine that knew if someone just sent $6 million from Romania and they've never sent more than $2,000, you know, we should probably flag that and not let that money go through until we figure it out, right? So, so that these are hard coded rules with basic. There's interactions between rules. They're very hard to maintain. Machine learning is not necessarily an easy ball game either, but that's sort of like ossified intelligence.
So is that like the most basic chatbots also?
Yep. So the very most basic chatbots might fit in that same bill, where we have certain keywords we're looking for, or we have certain strings that we're going to respond with and certain orders based on, you know, looking for patterns. And oftentimes those very basic chatbots obviously are going to be extremely, extremely limited. There really isn't very much business value for, 99% of chatbots at that level of limitation, mm-hmm. despite what the vendor companies will tell you. The idea of machine learning here, Andrew, is that we are able to, instead of ossifying the decision-making process, we can take a whole bunch of instances of something. So, you know, we could use cancer diagnostics as a random example. You know, you feed through tens of thousands of images of a chest x-ray where someone does not have lung cancer, and then 10,000 where they do have lung cancer, and then you pipe in, you know, 10,000 that aren't labeled, and a machine will be able to learn based on previous instances and based on feedback from a human as to whether or not this machine, this image is likely to have lung cancer beyond, let's say, a 90% percentile or not. And so when humans go in and they look at the machine's outputs, they can actually feed the system back in. They can say, hey, you called this lung cancer, but it's not. Hey, you didn't call this lung cancer, but it is. Or they can approve when it's the proper decision. And then that'll help to feed the decision-making process of the machine. It is a little bit of a black box. It is quite amorphous and tough to interpret sometimes. Mm-hmm. But it's exceedingly capable for particular kinds of tasks. And this is what's put AI on the global stage.
It would seem like the more time that goes on, and the more interaction and feedback that you get from the human, let's say in this case with the x-rays that are saying, yes, you're right, no, you're wrong, that's the learning process.
Yes, the more feedback, the better is what we would hope. But there's all these funky little edge cases. So we're going to talk about financial services. Most of our research work, so the bulk of our clients are wealth management, banking, insurance. So financial services is where we live. I gave you a medical example for simplicity's sake. But even in medical, there's challenges here where if, let's say, we start doing a lot more chest x-rays, you know, in South America with, you know, smaller kids that live in places with really bad air quality, and so some of them have lung cancer, our models that were trained on, you know, 98% adult chest x-rays may not work as well for whatever weird reason in terms of how lung cancer manifests in children. So we can't necessarily transfer our learning unless the circumstances are more or less the same. This is the hard part about using quote-unquote machine learning to trade on the market. These candle, you know, if we're just taking machine learning and asking it to understand the patterns of a candlestick chart, the actual underlying factors of the world that are moving that candlestick chart are what we would want to train the machine learning algorithm on. The candlestick chart is just a response of emotion and other things moving around in the world. And so we can't necessarily say more training is always better results in all circumstances. And finance is one of the absolute most elusive.
So when it comes to the market, since we skipped over to that discussion for a second, when we look at the old days where there was individuals making decisions on, okay, you know, with you can envision this, right? You got a big table, you got, let's just pretend it's one person for a moment, not a whole staff, but one person, and they got their newspapers out and they got their charts that they're either looking at on a computer or they're maybe hand writing on and doing all their research, understanding and calculations and maybe using a spreadsheet. Now what's happening is the ability for the machine to try to interpret the information in a much quicker way to, I guess, get ahead of everybody else of what's happening, whether it's trends or whether it's a particular movement or maybe an outside occurrence, is really putting that whole thing to the test, right?
Yeah, it absolutely is. Would you like me to talk about this dynamic? Because this is among the most important ones for your listeners,
sure.
I think. Okay, so the broad dynamic of artificial intelligence, when it comes to where can machine learning layer value on top of sort of the wealth management process. Not that long ago, I was in New York City in one of the trading floors in Citi. We actually have one of our research advisors is reasonably high up in markets and security services at Citi. And they've all got their own hypotheses about what they're trading on. You know, some people are doing currencies, some people are doing, you know, tech stocks, mm-hmm. whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. And they all have a thesis about what's going to go up, what's going to go down, how they like to make their decisions. What AI is beginning to help us do, Andrew, is to do what we might think of as quantifying the unquantifiable. So let me throw a couple examples at you. Let's just say I know that if there's more traffic to a lot of these different, you know, seaports in the Philippines, then that's going to have a certain tendency in terms of an influence on that currency. Okay, let's just say that hypothetically.
Yeah.
Normally, it's like, what do I have to do? I have to guess how much Nike is shipping. I have to guess how much, you know, I got to call a guy on the docks that I know, and I don't know if that's insider trading or something. But, you know, there's it's pretty tough to quantify you know, traffic and number of cargo units that are getting yanked off and placed onto, you know, these six ports in the Philippines. However, if we can have satellite imagery automatically find a way to quantify at least the number of boats that come to port and some rough estimate of the cargo that leaves it and gets loaded onto it, and we can have that as a dashboard to look at, we have now quantified what was previously unquantifiable. Now, is that going to make me money automatically? Hell no.
Yeah, hell to the no.
However, is that going to potentially allow me to inform my thesis-driven decisions at a better granularity than my competitors or my coworkers? Yeah, possibly it will. And so this is the broad paradigm, and there's a lot of this quantifying of the unquantifiable that absolutely doesn't make us money. And if you got a crap hypothesis, you're losing money regardless. However, it can allow us to execute on the right decisions with a tighter view to what's actually happening in the world based on just what's happening.
Well, it's additional confirmation that leads you to the next level, you know?
Yes.
And that's what it is. But, you know, it's interesting because one of the things we've been looking at lately – so let's go backwards. Let's go back. I don't know how long you've been in business, but let's go back to 2006.
Okay, I was definitely not doing market research at that time. However, let's go back anyway.
Yeah, let's go back. We're going back in. We're going back in the machine. Back
high
to
school.
2006.
Okay,
yeah, 2006. Yep. Now back then we were looking at things called what was it called? Crane something or other. We were counting the cranes in the various cities around the world to understand what was happening with the real estate market. There was a crane spotter. That was called. It's Crane Spotter. Back in the early days of the internet with the dial-up, we were looking at, you know, what was happening in the maps that would overlay where the cranes were, counting the cranes, and looking at what's happening. Very similar to what we're doing now.
I like it. Yeah.
Which is counting the infection rate from the coronavirus around the world, right? That's kind of like the thing that you look at. So we're wondering, like, what's going on with this? And we were kind of looking at that and saying, you know, we see this incredible buildup in this particular area and, like, just never seen before amount of building that's going on. Is that going to be sustainable or not? My point is, that crude look was one piece of the puzzle to try to understand what was happening with that market. Yeah. And it's kind of like you've taken it, and obviously we have much better computer technology, faster, you know, everything is just a lot better. Let's just leave it at that. We know what we're talking about there, right? But the ability to actually quantify this now with a lot of other components, which may be movement of population. For example, I'm throwing this out to you, right? You'd maybe add that to that thesis.
Yep.
Look at what's happening possibly with the stock market there. And if there is some wealth being, wealth happening, look at the ports in the area surrounding it, how much import is coming in. Is this really something that's happening or is it not? And today we're looking at, again, kind of fast forward in a very similar fashion to the coronavirus, right? Where Johns Hopkins put that great page together that gives us some ability, which may not be accurate, but some ability at least to get the number of current infections and the spread, how it's been moving with a map. So these are the kind of things you're talking about, maybe to the next level, to help us understand and help you provide for investment decision.
100%. Yeah. And again, you know, at Emerge, we're not actually building any of these technologies. However, we are surveying the landscape and getting a sense of what the capability ranges are. Because when a company like a city is going to start to integrate some of these technologies and spend millions on just a pilot, they want to work with firms that are going to deliver results and allow them to have the capabilities that they actually want. So for an individual trader at home, this stuff might be harder to get your hands on. But for the folks who are tuned in and that are professionals, it's kind of expensive to upgrade to this stuff. But yes, you're right. It's kind of like crane spotting. It reminds me of that movie Train Spotting.
Yeah.
It's crane spotting on steroids. And what's interesting about it, Andrew, is that we see this being used, and there's a huge – we have a whole kind of ontology of the capability range of AI and wealth management, and there's so many interesting pockets. But to look at sort of how this is being used, it's so varied. So sometimes folks in more of the day trading world, the swing trading world, will simply look at – they'll set up a number of – it's possible to set up a number of sort of trackers around media and press. So tell me when Nike gets mentioned in the press, and tell me when it has to do with these six topics, and tell me when the sentiment is either positive or negative. So negative sentiment would be Nike sucks because they've got workers that are only 12 years old, or Nike is great because they're recycling ocean plastic, you know, whatever the case may be, okay? So we're looking at sentiment, and we're looking at certain patterns of mentions of certain brands. And we may find that even at a candlestick chart level, there's some rough correlation. We'll set a bunch of hypotheses up. We'll figure out that one of them seems to track pretty well to either an industry or a company, and we might use that to start informing our decisions. Or we can make really long-term investment decisions about how we think the economy of Japan is going to be doing compared to its neighbors based on the cargo shipments and population movement and online activity and other kinds of correlates as well. So we can play this really short game, really long game. The possibilities of this informing of investment decisions is very broad and kind of a trend that absolutely is not going to be going away.
But the problem I want to pose this to you that
go for it.
If you're building something that looks at sentiment as an example, and you're scraping for mentions in media, maybe social media, maybe I don't know where you're using a lot of different places, maybe Twitter. You know, you're really trying to bring all this together, right?
Yep.
And if somebody gets a hand on that or an idea that somebody's doing that, which we know is happening. Tape reading algos are all over the place, right?
Yep.
What's to prevent them to create the dastardly algo that makes you think something's happening, push it in out there, right? They not only can they do the algo, but they'll do the social media push. We'll call it fake news. We'll call it made-up news.
Yeah.
We'll call bogus headlines. How do you get away from that?
Oh, man. I mean, well, I'll tell you this. So you asked, how do you get away from that? You don't get away from the state of nature until you die. So that's how you get away from it.
Uh-huh.
So only death will bring you from the state of nature. So the way it works, Andrew, as you're well aware, is that there will always be oppositional forces that are duking it out to see who can win, right? Animals and nature are going to eat each other until the end of time, and businesses are going to find ways to best each other and sometimes cheat each other until the end of time. And so the way that this is going to work is it's going to be like cybersecurity. So if we look at how AI is developing in cybersecurity, the more AI tools we develop to pick up on invasive patterns of people entering our back end or creating fake accounts or starting to pull our data out of our databases without us knowing or whatever the case may be, the more ways we find those patterns, the more someone else is going to develop AI applications to create patterns that appear normal and so don't trigger the alarm. And so exactly as you're saying, if we have a sense that a lot of folks are using sentiment and media mentions to make trades, it might be possible to really throw a wrench in the gears by figuring out ways as an investment firm or maybe in really small markets, an individual or something, to try to create the kinds of noise that would throw those algorithms off and give them absolutely the wrong idea. Now it'll develop again, Andrew. Here's the state of nature for you. So it'll develop again. They're going to figure out ways to determine which news is garbage and which news is real.
Right.
Maybe we need to limit it by which media outlet, by which author. I mean, and it's only going to develop and develop. And they're going to have hypotheses about how to get rid of fake news. And you know what? Their first six of them are going to be wrong and they're going to screw up. Mm. And then eventually they're going to find firmer hypotheses and ways of training these systems to get rid of fake news. And the cycle will continue until humans are gone.
Yeah, it's interesting because I know of a particular circumstance recently, not that recently, but where there was some scrub of some data where somebody picked up the tail number for a private jet that was from a particular company, and they looked up the flight plan, I suppose, and they figured out, oh, wait a second, they're going to visit this other company that happens to be in that same town. Now, whether or not they were or not, it's another story, right? But they were going on their way to that particular town. Like, oh, must be a merger or buyout or some other kind of deal happening here, and they bid the other stock up dramatically. So same kind of weird stuff that goes on. So when we're looking at the idea of this whole thing and we're looking at the potential now of what we touched on was the fake news, but what about the area of deep fakes? Are you studying any of that?
Certainly. So when the United Nations wanted to get a better understanding of deep fakes and have a presentation on the topic at United Nations headquarters in New York, as it turns out, they actually called on us. So
there you go.
So there was a video that we presented at United Nations headquarters of us taking the director of UNICRI, which is the crime and justice wing of the United Nations. We took their director and we essentially made her kind of say and do, you know, things she hadn't done. So made her face move and made her make statements that were different from a 1 minute recording that she had provided us with. And so we did a little bit of manipulation on this thing just to be able to take the people in the room and spook them and say, hey, if this showed up on your phone and it was a little bit grainy, you may very well have been on. And if we could have improved the quality maybe a little bit, you'd very well not really realize that this wasn't this person, for example. So we've presented on this topic for Interpol, for the United Nations. There's a lot of organizations that are really scared of this technology. And frankly, Andrew, I think they should be. When this election cycle comes around, we are going to see a confluence of these technologies. You know, unfortunately, maybe a hefty load of that is going to come from, you know, outside, you know, actors, other countries. And I think it's going to throw wrenches in the gears like we're absolutely not prepared for at all. So I have near-term and long-term thoughts on deepfakes. It's definitely part of a much greater long-term trend. But let me know what you want to know.
Well, I mean, that's it. I mean, the point is that you start getting into these computerized thinking processes where we're creating false data and where we're having it to be utilized for some either monetary gain, political gain, or otherwise. It starts getting me a little bit kind of frayed at the edges. You know what I'm saying?
I think that there will be a healthy number of years where we are really kaflimped about how to exactly handle that. I mean, I just to give you an idea, on mainstream channels, like let's say CNN or, you know, one of these, you know, Bloomberg TV or something, it's much less likely that they are going to immediately buy into some random video of some unlikely act and say, oh, we caught a video, right? But the fact of the matter is this. This is the global shift, and this is how we presented it at UN, and there's much bigger forward-looking consequences. But if we say near term, here's the deal. For the last 100 years, for, you know, five generations or so, well, more than 100 years, audio, video images were artifacts of events that happened, right? There's no fake audio. Somebody made that noise. There's no fake photograph. Somebody took that picture, right? Of course, we've had Photoshop, but we're talking about a whole nother level than Photoshop, mm-hmm. as you're well aware here. Mm-hmm. And video, by golly, that's really hard. There's no fake videos out there. But now, as it turns out, there are, and they're getting astronomically more realistic, you know, every 12 months, 18 months. And we've been following this stuff for the last 3 years. And so the fact of the matter is now, they used to be artifacts of things that happened. Now they aren't. That cold fact, that new reality is actually really spooky. And by the time we're another 2 or 3 years ahead from now, Andrew, it will be possible for any reasonably technical computer science college student to create borderline indistinguishably clear video of, I don't know, a teacher or a celebrity or anybody they can get enough audio and video data from. And that's a really wild world that we fall into, because while big, smart, you know, well-known, reputable brands may have filters in place where they absolutely insist on the validity of information, social media doesn't have any such filter.
Right, exactly. And the other problem is that it doesn't seem like we have any internet police seriously, isn't that where we're going? We have all, this is like an entirely new road that we're on, and there's nobody monitoring how fast, slow, or outside the boundaries that anybody is. And then with the advent of social media, where everybody is a star, man, you know, everybody has a podcast, everybody has a social media page. Just about everybody seems to have a TikTok page these days, and go on and on with the fact that, you know, now to be a food critic, all you have to do is get an Instagram account, which, okay, I mean, I'm not negative. I don't have, everybody wants to play, everybody can play. But, you know, then you see all this other nonsense. And what happens is it's not only just nonsense. It's the resharing process. It's the regurgitation of the falsehoods that people are. I mean, you know, when I'm on when I look on a Facebook or a Twitter and you start saying, hey, check this link out. And then you see all the different retweets. I'm like, what is that? You didn't read the article probably. And you're just passing this around. And it becomes just a toxic mess. And I guess that's what hopefully some AI in a way could start clearing the way through.
Yeah, well, so you're talking about AI cutting through the fakes.
Yeah, AI. Talking about AI being the police.
Yeah, here we get AI being the police. Well, yeah, we could talk about the long term stuff. And if anybody wants to look me up on YouTube and hear some TED talks about the post human transition, you can scare yourself at night. But
are we talking about Cyberdyne? Are we talking about Cyberdyne?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
But yeah, to talk about the internet police, yeah, this is another dynamic. I think you're touching on some really important things here, Andrew, that just like in the trading markets, when we understand when we have good hypotheses about how people are making decisions based on data in the world, maybe we can manipulate it. Similarly, when we know how people are creating these deepfakes, maybe we can find algorithms that can detect what is programmatically generated content. However, there's obviously going to be an arms race here. I made the cybersecurity analogy, and I'll make it here again. When we come up with algorithms that can detect whether or not a video is programmatically generated or an image is programmatically generated on some kind of a, let's say, 0 to 99% confidence, is it or is it not programmatically generated, then that will serve, that literally that output will serve as feedback to build the algorithms that are creating the better fake stuff. So that feedback loop, that quote-unquote adversarial feedback loop, between these AI systems, we'll be able to continually refine the quote-unquote bad guys. And so the only way I can realistically see us getting out of the woods here, Andrew, is a few things. First, at a hardware level, having some kind of an encryption or some kind of hardware baked-in features where if somebody uploads a video and there's essentially no chance of it being tampered with from their Samsung phone or whatever, that it might have some kind of a green checkbox on it. Similarly, if you go on Google Images or you go on YouTube, there should be videos that have a green checkbox on them because by some geo-tracker, some crypto identification, some internal hardware system, we just believe that 99% plus this has not been programmatically altered, then we could throw the green checkbox on it. And obviously the CNNs of the world and the Bloomberg TVs of the world can make sure that they screen things through this method as well. But that still leaves us with a massive swath of the open internet and the social media landscape that may need to be, as you put it, policed. Mm-hmm. But that is going to be an adversarial fight, Andrew. And I think traders and regular folks with social media accounts, whether you're in financial services or not, that should be a little concerning.
I hear you. No, I get it. I mean, you know, we don't want the oversight, but we do want the oversight, you know, as long as it suits our needs, right? You know, as long as something's not being done to us and we're protected, but yet at the same time, that always becomes a very, you know, a tightrope to walk where, you know, how much and how little is that really protecting me versus preventing me?
Yeah. It's a spooky world we're walking into. Luckily, Andrew, what I will say is, now they're very baby step conversations, but even at places like UNHQ, they are thinking about what governance would look like. And there's other organizations like the IEEE and the OECD that are also giving policy thought to some of these security considerations of AI. So it's early days, but my guess is by the time this election is over, that thought process will ramp up 20-fold because the instances thereof also ramp up 20-fold.
Exactly. Dan Fajella from Emerge Artificial Intelligence Research. Where can people find out more information?
Yeah, well, if folks want to learn more about Emerge, it's just emerj.com. Probably your audience is more interested in the finance side of things. So we have kind of a brief cheat sheet, more or less, about where AI is impacting finance. And that's just emerj.com/FIN. And then the number one. So FIN as in finance, emerj.com/FIN1. And that's kind of our finance cheat sheet. If people want to see everything, they can go to the regular website. But most folks are probably just going to want to know how it's going to affect their sector. And so check out that site.
All right. Well, we'll also have information and your a little bit of bio about you on the show notes for episode number, 655 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We'll make sure to do that as well. Give out your Twitter handle as well.
Yeah, just at Dan Fajella. So my last name is a little funky. It's F-A-G-G-E-L-L-A, but at Dan Fajella, you're going to be able to find me on Twitter and let me know you heard about me through Andrew.
All right, great. Listen, Dan, have a great one. Be safe, be healthy, and we'll talk to you on the other side.
All right.
Thanks. So as we bring this to a close this week, I want to mention a couple other things here. You know, I'm very concerned about a few things. One of the things I've been concerned about with what's going on, the amount of stimulus that's being provided by the various governments and Fed and central banks around the world is, are we going to see debt downgrades? Are we going to see sovereign ratings come down? You know, if we have a $2.2 trillion stimulus package and we're going to see major unemployment, a much lower level of taxes coming into the United States, and a global recession and all the trimmings that come along with that, are we going to possibly see a debt downgrade? Now, as I was thinking about that on Wednesday and Thursday, lo and behold, Fitch comes out with a affirmation of the United States AAA credit rating. And that was the headline. But below that number, there was a lot of ifs, but if, and it could be, we don't know. And then we saw just this weekend, or at the close, I guess, after Friday, Fitch downgrading the United Kingdom's long-term issuer default rating to AA minus from AA, with an outlook being negative. So they said that this is commensurate and necessary policy response to contain the COVID-19 outbreak and will result in a sharp rise in general government deficit and debt ratios. That's not only for them, by the way, that's for everybody. They go on to say, leading to an acceleration in the deterioration of public finance metrics over the medium term. The negative outlook reflects our view that reversing the deterioration in the fiscal metrics beyond 2020 will not be political priority for the UK government. Moreover, uncertainty found and around the future trade relationship with the EU could constrain the strength of the post-crisis economic recovery. So this is the problem that we're leading into. It's not only government and sovereign debt, which is a big issue. You start getting downgrades there, people get a little bit wonky. And that's why you've seen this rush to treasuries. It's also the concern about municipalities, corporate bonds, and everything in between. We've seen already a tremendous sell-off in certain areas of the bond universe. Municipals took a big hit, especially in certain areas, where they're going to have a problem raising the money from taxes and property taxes and even a sales tax to meet their payment requirements on their bonds. And we've seen some of the mortgage-backed REITs drop 70 or 80%. And we see municipals drop dramatically. So property issues are going to become a concern as well. Now, I'm not trying to doom and gloom and freak everybody out totally, but let's be realistic. Let's be realistic. You can't just keep on throwing on all of this amazing amount of stimulus on a fiscal and monetary base where you're actually causing your deterioration. That's what you want to do, right? You want to debase your currency. It's a race to the bottom. Whose currency could be worth less? So it's much more... it's much more of a benefit to buy their products versus the other guy whose currency is higher. So it puts you in pole position when we're talking about imports and exports. So all this being said, all that's happening right now, and I get back to this discussion that we started out with and now back all the way, roping this right around to the same point, is be aware. You have maybe some time on your hands right now. If you're working from home, take a break. Spend a little time and think about, really, okay, what does the outlook really look like for me in my own job and my situation? And what is the outlook for my money, my financial situation? Go into a corner for a moment. Just maybe take a pad with you or your notepad from your phone. Jot it down what it really looks like and what could really be spectacular to end this in quick fashion and just get back right on where we were, which was, by the way, coming into this, an overvaluation bubble that was created by the Fed because of all their stimulus in a time that wasn't necessary. Let's call it what it is. Everybody's yelling at me, the guy talks about the Fed all the time. What are you doing? Last year was an abomination what they did. They had no reason whatsoever to cut rates three times into a period when we had historically low unemployment and a stock market that was generally, aside from the beginning of the year, at all-time highs. Yes, they could have done a pivot in December, January, and said, you know what, we're not going to raise rates for a while. Maybe done, if they had to, just bring it back a little bit, maybe done one cut just to kind of bring it back. But those last two cuts were absolutely unnecessary, and they should be embarrassed. As we say all the time, the Fed will take us into and out of recession every single time and not call one of the recessions correctly along the way. So with that, I want to thank you for joining us this week. Be around next week. And again, of course, DH Unplugged on Tuesday evening with John C. Dvorak. And if you want me, you know where to find me. Thanks a lot for joining me, and I'll see you again next week. Be safe, be healthy, be prepared. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.